house in the forest. Fa la la. I'm filling it with all your favorite things. Fa la la. There's a rainbow trout swimming in the river. Fa la la. There beneath the waterfall where we will bathe. Oh, I hope that you enjoy our little hideaway. Fa la la. Maybe you'll even wanna stay. I put a lot of love into this little place. And when your world turns inside out, darling, you be the melody. I will sing your harmony. Together we will live out all our days in our treehouse. I made a table out of seashells. Driftwood is a frame beneath the bed. There's an arrow in the door, but it's not pointing anymore. No, that was just a lousy shot I made. Oh, I hope that you enjoy our little hideaway. Maybe you'll even want to stay. I put a lot of love into this little place. And when you're...
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
That's Doc Watson, one of the many artists you can hear on the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, when we share a wide variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music with you from 5:30 to 7 a.m. Each week, your hosts Dan Schrammack and Stephen Morrison bring you some of our favorite new releases and plenty of vintage favorites. It's a great way to start your Fridays, discover some new music, and find out about shows and festivals coming to the area. You can also find show playlists and listen to archive shows on demand via our website at kboo.fm and also via our free mobile app. That's the Cascadia Coffee House each Friday morning, where you hear a variety of traditional and contemporary folk and roots music from 5:30 to 7, right here on KBOO. We hope you'll join us.
Support for KBOO comes from KBOO members and Silverton People for Peace, presenting the 22nd annual Silverton MLK Observance, Monday, January 20th, featuring poetry readings, a community potluck, and keynote speaker Trevina Cassis. More information at kboo.fm/community-events.
Hello and welcome to Pathways, where you are invited to join me for a visit with leaders in personal development and cultural evolution. This is your host, Paul O'Brien. Nearly 30% of Americans will suffer from an anxiety disorder at some point in their lives. Research has now revealed that mental illness is on the increase, especially in younger people. But anxiety is not your fault. There are many factors that contribute to developing a mind that is prone to intense anxiety. And if you have such a mind, there are many things you can do to change the way it works. Such concepts as mindfulness, acceptance, compassion, and self-compassion that were once associated with Eastern meditative practices or dismissed as New Age are now central therapeutic concepts in the subject of worldwide research. Our guest today is Dr. Dennis Turch, author of the book The Compassionate Mind Guide to Overcoming Anxiety, Using Compassion-Focused Therapy to Calm Worry, Panic, and Fear. Dr. Turch is one of the foremost experts on compassion-focused therapy in the United States. His work with compassion is grounded in an extensive history of work in cognitive behavioral therapy, acceptance and commitment therapy, and Buddhist psychology. Dr. Turch is the founder and director of the Center for Mindfulness and Compassion-Focused Therapy and the associate director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy. Both centers are located in New York. He brings his experience of using compassion-focused therapy to the treatment of anxiety and other disorders. Well, hello, Dennis, and welcome to the Pathways program.
Well, hello, and thanks so much for having me. I've really been looking forward to having a chat.
Well, as I said in my intro, it seems like anxiety is a growing problem. At least it seems that way to me. Are you noticing that as a therapist? Are we living in an age of greater anxiety?
I think that's an important observation, and certainly the data on rising rates of anxiety problems would support that. And it's something that I see in my everyday life with my clients. And I bet most of the people listening have noticed this trend towards a lot of things in our popular awareness and our popular culture, our political landscape, raising our experience of a perceived threat. And it's not just here, it's pretty much a global phenomenon.
Now, as you point out in your book, anxiety is actually an essential emotion. What good is it?
Well, that's a great point. I mean, anxiety is pretty foundational, pretty fundamental. Just right after maybe, you know, eating and breathing is our ability to protect ourselves from threats. And it's baked in terms of our evolutionary history, that our threat perception will be able to seize the wheel. It'll be able to take over our awareness and our attention, because, you know, that's how we've evolved. That's how our species and how animals in the flow of life have evolved. So without anxiety, if we could, you know, wave a magic wand and get rid of our ability to feel anxious, you know, we'd probably just, you know, blissfully walk into traffic and get hit by a bus or something like that. So it's a very important thing to be able to detect threats.
And when does that become problematic?
I think the key for us is when that system is hyper-stimulated in a way that just isn't workable, or when our relationship to the experience of anxiety is sort of tyrannical, you know? So either we have too much arousal of our anxiety system and our threat system, particularly through symbolic representations, thoughts in the mind, meanderings of things that are not at all on our actual threat list, or our images from our culture, images from the internet or television, etc. Or when we just have a learning history which has caused us to become really excessively dominated by threat, by the perception of threat.
And this threat detection system, this is one of three emotional systems that we have in our psychology, right?
Yeah, this is a sort of a key insight that my mentor and the founder of Compassion Focused Therapy, Paul Gilbert, derived, taking a long, hard look at the emotional neuroscience literature and also our evolutionary history. We can see three primary emotion systems, one that involves our detection and response to threats, another which involves how we're motivated by acquisition of resources, or we feel driven to pursue goals. And a third, which relates to our experience of social safeness, connectedness, and warmth and affiliation.
Mm-hmm. And so what you're teaching through the use of the therapeutic techniques and the compassion-focused therapy is how to regulate this threat detection part of the system, because it's kind of run amok to some extent.
Yeah, and it's sort of everywhere. When you look into the core problems of human existence, you know, this is something, what did the Buddha say, you know, which is just the Buddha, just means the one who woke up, you know, like this sort of historical teacher who kind of revolutionized thought in, you know, Asia and eventually the world. What was this core teaching? It was that life is going to involve pervasive suffering, kind of feeling like a wheel out of balance. Dukkha, the Sanskrit or Pali word, means a wheel out of balance. We're going to suffer to the extent that we either, you know, are driven and dominated by a craving for things to be the way they just can't be, or the way we try to avoid and shun the way things are. And those two qualities really relate to drive, wanting, craving, and to threat, things, you know, fear, avoidance, and you know, when we take a close look at the way the brain evolved, we're set up for a lot of trouble because we're going to have this always on, better safe than sorry, 24/7 threat detection system. And it can be triggered by thoughts, it can be triggered by images, and it can express itself as anger, as rage, it can express itself as fear or terror or panic or worry. It can express itself as such pervasive shame and experience of social threat that we shut down and feel depressed. So learning to come to terms with the potential tyranny of our threat system through mindfulness and compassion and stabilization of our conscious awareness is really the core of most of the wisdom traditions in the world. And I think we're finding it to be the core of effective psychotherapy.
You know, if only our threat detection system was more calibrated to reality, we'd probably be feel more grateful for it. But now, you know, now we have, you know, we worry about stuff, we imagine catastrophic outcomes, we're so on guard that we actually shun anxiety and we judge ourselves for feeling it. This is part of the problem. You point this out in the book, that as if feeling anxious and stressed were not enough, we can become fearful of these emotions and try to suppress or avoid them, even becoming self-critical for feeling overly anxious. So this just makes it worse, right?
It certainly does. You know, one of the things that really struck me when I first became a psychotherapist, you know, like 20-odd years ago, was how much shame and blame was showing up with anxiety disorders. You know, it was the era of cognitive behavior therapy, and a lot of the things I learned were brief, direct interventions to try to tackle anxiety head on. And then I realized that there was this confounding variable that people were beating themselves up and shaming themselves. And we know from the research literature that shame as a trans-diagnostic process, across diagnoses, across problems, across people, the presence of excessive shaming and blaming makes it much harder to overcome problems with anxiety and to live our lives effectively.
And this is where compassion can play a positive role.
Yes, certainly. Compassion, interestingly, works on a couple of levels. It works on de-shaming, de-pathologizing, and de-blaming this hostile inner critic that makes things much worse. And it also works directly on our threat system, which is a little bit weird at first. Like, why would being compassionate to others or ourselves even help us to feel less scared? And in order to understand that, we need to take a little bit of a closer look at human evolution and parenting. Mm-hmm. So I could kind of lay that out for a moment.
Yeah, please do.
That's okay.
Yes,
sure.
Please.
Yeah. I always pause for a moment before that because I don't want to just launch into, you know, in the beginning, you know. But if we think about it, human beings, you know, we have evolved with a unique human brain. It's the largest of the primate brains. It's 1,450 cc's relative to, say, a chimpanzee brain, which is like a third of that. And with this unique capacity, not just for thinking and reasoning and the experience of a self, cognition, but also for massive cooperation and caregiving, which means that we're able to communicate and look after one another on this super sophisticated way, like no other species ever has. And part of that has to do with directly with the way that we're cared for and the way we care for one another. Because our chief evolutionary advantage is our ability to learn, is our ability to symbolically represent things, and because we're born with this massive brain, we have a very low birth rate, actually. And we also have a very risky childbirth process. So as a result, it's very important that we're looked after and that we're tended to until we're mature and able to function on our own. And what that means is an extended period of caregiving when, as offspring, we're very fragile. And so as a result, secure, warm, affiliative bonds and a caring, nurturing relationship between parent and also by other members of a family or community and a child or infant, even up through adolescence, this actually serves to slow down our threat response. So we're wired so that when we feel socially safe, when we feel cared for, when we feel protected, we're able to go out, explore, and funnily enough, even take risks. And Lao Tzu said this thousands of years ago, that when we feel great love for someone, it gives us courage. We're willing to face danger to protect the ones we care for. And then also, feeling loved gives us strength. So we're able to experience what is known as passive safeness, where we can rest, calm, soothe, and center, but also active safeness, where we're willing to face challenges. And this is what we call fierce compassion. That's actually the next book I'm working on right now, which is about the link between compassion and courage and how compassion is anything but weak. It means the ability to face the darkness. As Paul Gilbert says, the strength to descend into the reality of human experience. So it's a funny thing that owing to the weird, you know, circumstances of evolution on this weird little planet, we have this tricky brain which finds itself stabilized and courageous and ready to explore when we feel loving and loved and warm and safe socially. And that's part of why we are who we are.
This is kind of where compassion-focused therapy intersects with attachment theory. Like, for instance, you know, as you're saying, we come into the world and hopefully we have a secure attachment with our mother or our primary caregiver, and that helps us learn how to settle down the threat detection system, and we learn how to soothe ourselves and go out and try things, like you were saying. And so do you feel like compassion-focused therapy offers hope for people who were not parented very well?
I absolutely feel that compassion-focused therapy and the science of compassion and training the mind in compassion definitely offers hope in that direction. You know, Dan Siegel does a beautiful job at getting at the news you can use in interpersonal, what he calls interpersonal neurobiology, summarizing the research, for decades of research on attachment and human functioning in the brain. And what we see is that when someone experiences the emotions and states of mind, states of being that are embodied through warm, lasting, stable emotional connection with others, which is to say attachment. So when we experience secure attachment, the brain is very interesting. There's greater neural integration. There is greater flexibility in responding. We're able to balance and choose whether to pursue a valued aim or break off from that aim. And we have a possibility for transformation. We've known for thousands of years in Christianity, Sufism, esoteric Judaism, Buddhism, you name it. All of these schools of thought, all of the wisdom traditions and pre-scientific disciplines have taught that training the mind in compassion, warmth, and loving kindness transforms the mind. And as it turns out, we can see that in the neuroscience of attachment very clearly, actually.
You know, it's amazing how of these three emotional systems that you discuss in the book, the threat detection and then the drive towards success or achievement and that sort of thing, and then the soothing affiliation system, which is what we were talking about, that compassion is one of the aspects of that. You know, we don't hear anything about that third one, that soothing affiliation. We're like spending all of our time in either threat detection or striving like crazy. And so I think it's, I'm wondering, you know, that means that there's going to be a lot of anxious people, that there's going to be a lot of people who are triggered a lot. And so your job as a therapist, and one of the things I think about compassion-focused therapy is that you're empowering the client to learn how to intervene by tapping into that soothing affiliation system. Right? Is that right?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely.
So
absolutely. And you, please, yeah.
I was just going to say, what if they don't have anybody? What if they don't have a therapist? What if they learn this skill? What do they do? How do they do that?
Well, this is something you can learn through meditative practice, through imagery practice. It's something you can learn in small groups. It's something you can learn in many different ways, because it's actually sort of is bigger than the therapy. I mean, for specific psychological problems, therapy is extremely useful. And I'm a as a guiding principle in our schools, in our leadership, in our business practices, in our organizations. Not because that makes us nice or more pleasant, but because we know that from the moment you are born until the day that you die, every level of human functioning, from heart rate variability to immune system functioning to levels of depression to social engagement to physical health, all of that is affected positively when we move from a place of compassion and affiliation and an appreciation of our interconnectedness with one another. And so moving our society to a greater appreciation of that interconnectedness and having that be guiding our policies is crucial for the survival of the species, let alone life on the planet.
As opposed to rampant competitivism and what we see now being modeled by the powers that be in our country.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a brain that hasn't excessively changed in the last few 10,000 years, as far as we know, you know. It may have changed in some of its programming and its pattern, but the hardware system hasn't been updated, you know, in a little bit. And that brain evolved to be in small groups of people with lots of co-parenting in a village kind of a context where strong affiliative bonds were all around, not in places of alienation and separateness and rampant child abuse and substance abuse. And if you think about it, if I have my phone here and I'm speaking to you through a laptop and there's a television in the other room, there's all sorts of screens and electronic devices and information systems, you and I and most of the listeners will be exposed to more images and symbols of competition, threat, violence, and sexuality. We'll be exposed to more of those within 1 week than generations and generations of our ancestors were exposed to over the course of their entire lives. Our brain isn't set up for that.
You know, and as you point out in the book, and as Dr. Paul Gilbert points out in his book, it's not our fault. We live in this crazy world. We're born into a certain neighborhood, culture, society, and we have this tricky brain. And I guess really the first realization of self-compassion is to realize it's not your fault.
That's so important. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's not your fault.
Now, you say that compassion is not just an emotion, that it's more than that. It's a system. It's a strategy for interacting with the world. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, and I think part of that actually is found in that it's not your fault message that you so, you know, wonderfully bring to mind. When we work with our clients to help them to realize that they're born with this tricky brain with hundreds of millions of evolution have brought forth to adapt to the sorts of challenges that our evolutionary ancestors have faced, and that we didn't choose the brain, we didn't choose our place in the genetic lottery, we didn't choose our parents or the social learning conditions. We didn't choose the really complicated way that we think, or when we try to avoid thinking of something, we think it more. We try to avoid feeling of something, we feel it more. We didn't choose whether we were abused, or we didn't choose whether we were bullied. We didn't choose whether we had enough food to eat or not. We didn't choose whether our ancestors had to flee another country to avoid mass persecution. None of this we chose. So we just sort of arrive here as a version of ourselves, you know, just this one version of ourselves, really. But we can choose to take responsibility for who we become. And that's a hard thing to do because we're so dominated by our learning histories and our patterns of thinking and our evolutionary history. So how do we do that when we access compassion? And why would that be more than an emotion? Why would that be something more than just a clever idea or a Buddhist teaching or a Christian teaching? And that is because compassion links to our caregiving motive. It links to that unique human motive to care for and to be cared for. And those sort of evolved motives are very powerful. Our motive towards competition, just like a little baby turtle, you know, the mama turtle could go to the beach and lay 3,000 eggs, and maybe only 30 of those eggs will actually become future turtles. They'll find their way to the sea, and then they'll do their thing. They'll do their turtle thing. They'll just like, you know, and they don't need to be taught that. They don't need to go to turtle college or anything. They just like, they have all of those pre-birth instinctual repertoires, right? Where human beings have a blend of instinctual repertoires and also our elaborated, like, post-birth learning histories. So the human compassion motive, our compassionate mind, is part of our pre-verbal ancestral birthright of human motives. And it's also elaborated through our whole learning history. It involves emotions and thoughts and behaviors. So it's really an organizing principle of the mind that is involved in our personal liberation.
Beautiful. Well, we've only got a few minutes left, but I wanted to bring up the topic of mindfulness because there's this synergy between compassion and mindfulness. So can you speak to that, please?
Yeah, mindfulness is a core dimension of training the mind. It's a core dimension of optimal human functioning, and it's been practiced for thousands and thousands of years. We see it being elaborated by the Buddha, but even when he taught about mindfulness, he described it as being something that he had learned already. You can find the roots of it even in the Rig Veda, which is the sort of, you know, maybe 10,000 years old, maybe older. It's one of the first things that humans did culturally, as far as we know. Was to begin to appreciate how to train the mind and how to make sense of our place in the world and the universe. Mindfulness has kind of gotten a little bit misunderstood, which is just as a necessary side effect of something being disseminated in the West. What it means is an ability to contact our present moment experience as an observer, and yet with a penetrating awareness of the now. And to be able to remember to return to this present moment with great acceptance, and to be able to experience flexible, focused attention so that our mental events are experienced as what they are, not as what they say they are. Now, all over the world for thousands of years, this was a practice that was a preparatory practice, creating the necessary and sufficient conditions for subsequent wholesome personally, spiritually evolving qualities like compassion, like wisdom, like commitment. And the way mindfulness has been disseminated in the West for the last 15 to 20 years has de-emphasized sometimes, not always, but sometimes has de-emphasized that subsequent elaboration of the context of mindfulness. So I see mindfulness as like, you know, cardio or something like that. Like if I want to, I could do lots of good cardio. I could do road work and be a boxer. I could do road work and be a soccer player. I could do lots of things with that good cardiovascular fitness. And if you think, the structural fitness of functional fitness of personal awakening, that's what we're practicing when we practice mindfulness. But not necessarily like, you know, I heard Anderson Cooper, who I'm a big fan of and I kind of adore, actually, so I don't want to take a shot at Anderson Cooper, but he was kind of summarizing in a very user-friendly way, like mindfulness, I don't look at my phone as much, you know, I'm more present. And I know that he has a more deep understanding of that, but I thought, maybe there's a little bit more to personal awakening.
Right.
Whether or not, you know what I mean? Kind of. So we got to keep an eye out for the depth of mindfulness, not just the surface.
I think what's really relevant about mindfulness in this context of compassion-focused therapy is the fact that unless you're mindful of the fact that you are caught up in this worry syndrome, you can't call forth your soothing affiliation system and the self-compassion that could actually intervene with that. And boy, I wish we had a lot more time, Dennis, because we're just about out of time, and I want to make sure to share your new golden rule with our audience.
Oh, okay. Well, this is something that, you know, there are several folks who've said, Chris Germer from Mindful Self-Compassion and other folks have used this kind of inversion of the golden rule, which is, you know, the golden rule, a categorical imperative, the sort of idea that we should treat others the way we wish to be treated. And the sort of inversion of the golden rule, new golden rule, would be let's treat ourselves the way we would treat someone we love.
Beautiful. Let's treat ourselves the way we would wish to be treated by others. I think that's a great place to end, and I want to thank you very much for being on the show. There's so much more we could explore. The book is so deep, and I loved every page of it, but we have run out of time. And I want to be sure to tell our listeners about your website, which is www.mindfulcompassion.com. That's mindfulcompassion, all one word, .com. And for those who tuned into the Pathways show late, this is your host, Paul O'Brien, author of Great Decisions, Perfect Timing, a book that shares the theme of Pathways, which is personal and cultural evolution. In a second, I'll tell you how you can rewind and replay this interview whenever you want via the internet or as a free podcast. Today, we've been visiting with Dr. Dennis Turch, author of...
Radio's greatest application is in broadcasting mass entertainment. Probably one of the best ways to get started is to make it a hobby and build an amateur station. It will show you more quickly than anything else whether or not you can succeed in radio.
KBOO